Hello and welcome to Ed Talks, the podcast from King Edward School Birmingham and King Edward High School for Girls, where I talk to old Eds who've left school and gone on to pursue, well, in this case, quite a magical career. We'll come back to that in a second. My name's Ben Anderson. I left school in 2006. I went to Warwick University to study theatre, but ended up leaving university and going straight into the radio industry. I was a breakfast show producer for many years for Capital FM in Birmingham, ended up running radio stations for Capital in the north, but now run my own podcast production company, Sound Rebel. And this is one of my favourite podcasts to do. It's so good to talk to people who had pretty much the same start in life as you did in many ways, but went off in very different directions. Today I'm joined by somebody who I've known for an incredibly long time. I was best man at her brother's wedding. I've known her since she was 11 years old and getting on the train and coming across the Cross City line from Sutton Coldfield into Edgbaston. I'm delighted to be joined by Beth Heaven. Beth, hello, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much.
How are you?
Pleasure to be here. Yeah, I'm good, thanks. How are you doing?
Very well. It's nice to see you again so shortly after the last time I saw you, which was in Canada
for Seb's wedding. Across the pond.
It was a long way to go for not a long time, wasn't it? Because you had a couple of days there as well, didn't you?
Yeah. We only had, I think we were there for about 3 or 4 days in total.
Yeah.
After such a long time, it was strange to be away for... It was nice to be on a long-haul flight, though.
Yes, apart from having to wear the mask the whole time.
Yeah.
Anyway, we digress. Yeah. This might happen a few times in this podcast because we know each other so well. We'll just end up having a bit of a chit-chat. But no, let's talk about your career,
Perfect. First
of all, and give the kind of the intro. The reason I said magical is because you have got the most fantastic job. And surely everyone that you ever say what your job is to just go, oh my God, what's it like? Is it the best place ever? Is it magical? Is working for Disney a magical experience?
Yes, you're totally right. Everyone I ever tell, I think their first assumption is that I must work in the parks, that I must be one of the characters that you go and see in the parade and you get waved to. I'm not one of the characters, but I do work in the head office in London, and it's pretty magical. I get to do all the things that you'd hope that Disney would offer. And it's a super Disney office. There's like Disney characters in all the meeting rooms. They're often quite themed. So we've got like a full Pirates of the Caribbean meeting room. They've got a full life-size Johnny Depp figure in the corner. The lifts all play Disney tunes all day. So yeah, it's pretty magical.
Does Cinderella like ever just stroll in?
Yeah, Minnie was in the office yesterday.
Of course.
Because it was her birthday. Mickey and Minnie's birthday was yesterday, so they were in the office. we do get character appearances every now and again.
Wonderful. So you are your title is Partnerships and Digital Senior Manager at the Walt Disney Company. Have I got that right?
Yes, that is right.
So what do you do then? What is your day-to-day as Partnerships and Digital Senior Manager?
Oh gosh, I think that's where it's going to be the trickiest thing. The easiest way to describe it is that I work in marketing. I feel like that's where my kind of go-to that everyone somewhat understands. My brother has spent the last 8 years of my working life telling everyone that I work in PR. I don't. what I do, and this, the part of the business that I'm currently in, I've had a couple of different roles at Disney, but the part of the business I'm currently in is the products part of the business. So that is everything that you can possibly imagine. That is from a Mickey Mouse jumper that you might buy from H&M all the way through to some Star Wars Lego, to a Spider-Man toothbrush, any product that we've licensed out that is created that uses, our IP. I work with all of those partners and figure out how we can best market those products, how we can ensure that everyone still continues to love our characters, and that translates into a product sale. So that's exactly what I work on.
So what other areas of the business have you worked in then? So you're now in product, but what else have you covered before?
Yeah, so I've joined the business in a regional role now, so I look after my kind of marketing role across all of EMEA. But my first role in Disney was UK ad sales. So looking after, putting ads on the Disney channel in the UK, putting ads on our YouTube channel, looking at paid social. So working with the social team on how we advertise on our Instagram and our Facebook pages. Then I moved into a regional role that was working with the studio partnerships team. So again, if there was, a big studio title like, Mary Poppins came out, or any of the Star Wars releases, or Captain Marvel, working with partners. So whether it be an auto brand, or working with a tech brand, or working with a cereal brand, and how we can, massively amplify the marketing of that specific movie title. And then there was a huge merger. So Disney and Fox merged. Disney bought Fox maybe 2 years ago now. And with that, we actually inherited National Geographic. So they ended up working on the partnership team over at National Geographic. So again, doing something completely different, but I loved that. Obviously, that's looking at working with partners to, again, drive that kind of sustainability message. So looking at partners that are doing something really great in the green space. So yeah, that was super varied as well. I worked with like Nespresso and P&G, lots of different big brands then.
I mean, these are all brands that are household name brands. Do you ever get nervous? Because you're still really young doing this career. When National Geographic walk in, do you suddenly go, bloody hell, that's National Geographic? Like, did you ever feel nervous doing
it? Oh, totally.
Par for the course.
Yeah, I think you just have to be quite good at least being able to present as though you don't have a care in the world. Like, you know exactly what you're doing, you know exactly what you're talking about. But every single day I'll have a call where I'm totally out of my depth and I'm presenting to someone who is out in New York in the head office and is like VP of all of their, you know, marketing strategy. And I'm having to try and persuade them that, you know, whatever I'm talking to them is the best route for them. So yeah, I live my life with complete imposter syndrome, but I think you just have to at least know what you're talking about. So if you're like, do you know what, actually what I'm bringing to you, I really believe in. So I think that's what I've always tried to make sure that I'm in roles that I'm like, no, I think this is a really good idea. So it's much easier to take that out to any big brands, no matter who the senior partner is. But yeah, I've definitely been in scenarios. My old boss could have, you know, literally sold ice to Eskimos. And that's definitely helped reporting into people that are like, no, we work for Disney, guys. Let's not forget that.
Well, actually, that's exactly what I wanted to say next, because, you know, Disney's one of the biggest companies in the world. So they might be feeling that way about you when you walk into the room. It's magical, Disney. And we all have the kind of consumer experience of Disney. It's in basically every single house in the world, isn't it? In the Western world.
Disney, yeah, Mickey Mouse is something. Like the number one brand in the world.
It's really?
Yeah, the most recognised
brand. It doesn't surprise me. But it is magical and it is wonderful, but it's also a very big business.
Yeah, of course.
And you even talk about things like paid search there. And, you know, it's obviously what you do. It's a very serious job and it's a very big business that's got lots of expectation on your shoulders to do the job. Do you get credit because you're Disney? Like, do people just kind of expect that it's going to be great and that you're going to be great because it's Disney? Does that take pressure off or does that put pressure on?
I think it puts pressure on, and I'll tell you for why. This is so funny. We actually, the Metro recently ranked all of the Christmas ads, and they ranked the Disney Christmas ad as number one, but they were like, of course Disney made the best Christmas ad. They could make these animation, you know, these emotive animation in their sleep. It was like, we can't. There are people behind this, making this spot, like trying to make this a success. But I think the expectation is like, of course you should be able to do that because you're Disney. So I do think there is an expectation of, you know, you have this huge history of that magic that you need to live up to. Like, you absolutely have to live up to that. And yeah, I think that's happened with every franchise that we've taken over. Like, when we took over Star Wars, the expectation is like, oh, Disney gonna ruin it now, because there was, you know, so many fans that really loved that franchise. And I think, again, there's the expectation that, like, okay, how do we make sure that we don't do that? How do we make sure that we can maintain the credibility of Star Wars for everyone that loves it? So, yeah, I think it's a blessing. But, yeah, it's also very hard to constantly maintain that same level of output.
It's tough at the top, I suppose. There are some things as a consumer that you've told me before that it's just, can we talk about the fact that the Germans hate Toy Story?
Yeah. And you're going to get Germans writing into this podcast being like, no, I love Toy Story. Yeah.
But as a nation, the films don't work well.
Yeah.
And why is that? What's Germany's problem with Toy Story? It's one of my favourite Disney franchises.
I know. It's so interesting. There's so many nuances that, again, you're like, what? That you, when you kind of learn the intricacies of the Disney franchises, we've no idea. There's no, you know, one answer for exactly why Toy Story doesn't work in Germany, but they can't even market it as Toy Story.
How do you do that then? So
we had to actually, for Toy Story 4, we had to lead with the new characters. So we had to just show all the characters that weren't recognisable to the Toy Story franchise. So we couldn't show Buzz or Woody, we couldn't show Bo Peep, all the marketing showed any of the new characters that were going to feature in that film, like Forky, because he's not super recognisable for that franchise.
And were Buzz and Woody okay with that?
I mean, they had to have signed it off at some point, right?
Only when there were no humans in the room. And another one, how do you find this out? Like, is this something that's raised internally because there's some knowledge in the room, or is this based on feedback? Doesn't Moana mean something quite naughty in Italian?
Yeah, they had to change the film's title. So in Italian, yeah, she's called Vaiana. And
because it's a rude, you couldn't put, you know, Disney, the flack that Disney would get for putting that word on billboards across the,
yeah,
the nation in Italy would be terrible.
Yeah, they've had to completely rebrand it in Italy. Yeah.
Okay, let's take that example. Mm-hmm. How does that get flagged up?
Oh gosh, good question. I mean, these films are in development for like, what, between, you know, 5+ years. So it's not just that the Pixar guys are stuck in a room and they're figuring out what works. There are so much, you know, these films have to work globally. So there is so much input from so many stakeholders across the globe, especially with those sort of films. They always have, you know, cultural specialists to make sure that we're not including any cultural appropriation where we shouldn't. Like, there has to be so much thinking that goes into everything. So, you know, that again will have been flagged pretty early on when they had the idea of what the storyboard was going to look like, what the film was going to be called. Someone will have flagged it because they have to check everything globally because they have to make sure that something like that doesn't happen.
And again, we'll probably keep coming back to this, but Disney being such a big part of all of our lives. My girlfriend Jem is a presenter up here in Liverpool. She was recently interviewing, and I can't remember his title, but big top dog creative guy at Disney.
Amazing.
He was doing the rounds because they were touring the new, not Alice in Wonderland. Jem told me all about this, and I'm getting into a huge amount of trouble because she's going to tell me that I wasn't listening again. What is it? What's currently touring?
Beauty and the Beast.
Thank God you're on the ball. Yeah, and they gave, just in terms of that kind of thinking around it, you've got to think around it in terms of there's a responsibility that Disney have to make sure that, you know, Moana doesn't go on billboards in Italy. But also Disney has a responsibility to move society forward as well. The reason I bring up the Beauty and the Beast example is because in that production, Belle is wearing glasses. And it's only a really small change. It's just a bit of costume. But the creative fella, whose name I can't remember, I'm sorry, was talking to Jem about it and saying that, you know, Belle reads loads of books. So we wanted her to have glasses because we want little girls to come to this production and go, oh, she's wearing glasses just like me. That's just a small example. That's another. So you've got all the thinking around making sure that everything is okay. You've got all the development. But how much of that feeds into your work? Like, how much do you feel that Disney is a kind of a cultural pillar and therefore it has a responsibility to comment on what's going on around us?
Oh, yeah, huge. And I think the way that probably feeds most into what I do in this role is thinking about how we market products and who we market them to. So making sure that we are always inclusive, like, of girls in our Marvel marketing. I think there's all, you know, being really careful not to stereotype the play patterns of kids. And I know that there was a few years ago, of course, there was, you know, a really, really hot debate on social. There was some mini products that was marketed that was like a pink little mini vacuum and a pink little mini washing up set. And again, was like, why are we still conforming to these like complete gender stereotypes of a little girl doing the housework and that's the toys that we're buying her? So I think that's one of the, you know, huge takeaways that Disney is trying to solve, is making sure that we do include boys when we're creating marketing campaigns around Frozen, around Princess, you know. In reality, little boys at nursery are putting princess dresses on. And so we shouldn't be ignoring that, and we shouldn't be continuing to conform to all of those gender stereotypes, because it's not allowed for adult marketing. So it definitely shouldn't be included when we're creating and developing the products.
Can you do that? If you see something that you go, this doesn't sit right with me, can you go into a room and say, look, we shouldn't be doing pink vacuum cleaners?
Yeah, and I think the first conversation that we can have is like, this, we can't market this. We can't knowingly put this onto our social channels because we know that the outcry from this is going to be really negative. We know that the reaction from all of our audiences is going to be, this is so, so off trend. what are you doing? So actually, if we can't market it, then why are we making it? And so, yes, I think there will always be a degree of girls are playing with dolls, and to a degree, the marketing around that may be pinks and purples. But that said, it shouldn't exclude blue and green, and it shouldn't exclude boys playing with them. So I think, yeah, it's a funny balance, because there is so much insights to still show that, yeah, but girls are still buying dolls. So as much as we want to include boys in the marketing, you know, there is... it's a degree of like who our audience still are, who are still buying the products. But yeah, I think Disney have a huge responsibility to be, you know, gender inclusive, but also much more diverse in their marketing. And that's something that they, you know, especially for the last couple of Christmas ads, they've really, really taken on board to, like the stage shows, try and make sure that we are always hiring diversely and representative of, you know, all communities. Because like I said, Disney's huge. If such a huge brand can't do it and stand by it, then, you know, other brands are going to find it much harder to kind of lead the way.
This might be a difficult question to answer. You might not be able to answer this question. And as I said before we started recording, we're not live, so I can edit things out. what we talk about here doesn't need to make the final conversation.
Great.
But who are you targeting when it comes to marketing? Are you targeting children? Are you targeting their parents? Is it a bit of both?
Honestly, Ben, literally everyone. There is nobody.
Everyone loves Disney.
That's the thing, because we want to get kids loving Spider-Man. We want to get kids loving, you know, anything princess, because then they'll keep going to the cinemas when we're bringing out Little Mermaid live action, when we're bringing out these huge Marvel releases, when we're bringing out The Eternals. So, you know, we know that if we can get kids loving our franchises young, then we'll keep them through their life. So we honestly are targeting absolutely everyone. If we, you know, we want kids to love us, but we also want adults to go to the cinema, go and see our films, buy Disney Plus, go and buy the jumpers. So yeah, no one escapes.
Beth, your role is such a creative role, and I'd love to talk to you about that, because it's not just about what's the best way to position this. I love that you've got that kind of social conscience, both yourself and at Disney, and understand that kind of responsibilities. You sometimes do, with big corporations, you kind of feel that people are in big, tall, swanky offices and, you know, lots of glass everywhere, and you know, all they're thinking about is the bottom line. But it's not, is it? You know, Disney really is thinking about its place and its voice, and what, you know, the power that comes with that. It's wonderful to hear. Our listeners might be surprised to hear that you studied biochemistry at university.
Yeah, I did.
But now you're in this hugely creative role,
yeah,
marketing for one of the most creative companies in the world. Tell me about that then. So why did you decide to go and study biochemistry?
Oh yeah, quite the jump. Honestly, I had no idea what I wanted to do at uni. I had absolutely no idea. I think I must have written about 10 personal statements at school and driven them all mad by going in one day being like, I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to go and do law. And then the next day being like, nope, I've had a look again and I'm definitely going to do pharmacy. I think pharmacy's for me. And every day would be like, no, I think I should go and do speech therapy. I think that's probably where my skill set lies. I had honestly just no idea. And I think in the end, the head of year sat me down and was like, what are you good at? Just go and do something that you're good at. And was like, okay, I'll go and do science.
Look, I'm tired. Like, we've had so many of these conversations. Just please, just go and do what you're good at.
Just stop bringing all these weird and wonderful degrees to me. I'm sick of it. No, they were really good. And they actually extended the deadline because they were like, you're a lost cause. So every day I had a new idea and wrote up a new personal statement and then was like, no, I know that last time we spoke about criminology, but this time I really do know what I want to do. So I ended up just applying for my first degree that I applied for was philosophy. And then I had a gap year and changed my mind entirely and reapplied on my gap year and decided to go and do science. So I went and did a science degree, again, with every intention of just doing that as my backup plan and then becoming an actress. So I went to UCL because they have a huge West End size stage. So I was like, great, I'll go and do some science, but I'll also carry on doing some acting and then I'll just go and be an actress. That'll set me up perfectly. So that's kind of why I chose biochem.
Yeah. And did you enjoy it? Did you enjoy the... because that's a very... it's not your typical backup degree, is it? I mean, there's a lot that goes into biochemistry.
There was a lot of contact hours. And needless to say, I was the only person in the drama society that wasn't doing English. Yeah. But I did really enjoy it. I think as a transition from school to uni, having a lot of contact here, ours is probably the easiest kind of transition because I had a lot of lectures, I had a lot of labs. But rather than that being then sort of make sure that you're going away and you're studying everything by yourself, it is kind of a little bit of a continuation of school. So just being in, you know, 9 till 5 a lot of the days. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. I loved being in central London. And yeah, I kind of just saw, getting a degree as like, right, let's get this done. And then I didn't have a huge intention of staying with science. I was like, I found a lot of it really interesting, but wasn't ever planning on using that, which is, I think, in hindsight, probably what we should encourage young people not to do.
Well, we'll come back to that because your whole career journey has been an interesting sequence of events. So you finished at UCL, and what did you do next? You still had the desire to be an actor at this point?
Sort of. I actually was completely surrounded at UCL by economists. All my best friends were economists. I lived with just economists. I think most of my entire halls at uni, like the floor I was on, was pretty much all economists. So I kind of got swept up into that finance world a little. So everyone was applying for internships, and I was like, oh, this is what we do now. We just apply for an internship at one of the big four. Like, okay, everyone's doing that, so I should do that. And actually at the time, it was my brother that was like, what are you doing? You've never wanted to do finance. I was like, no, but this is what everyone does. Everyone's applying for summer internships. So I applied for one, and I applied fairly late on in the process. So I remember just having to pick whatever was left on the drop down. Most things were grayed out because they were full. And I went for my interview at the Big Four for my summer internship. And the guy in the interview was like, someone in the waiting room said to me, what are you here for? Is it tax or audit? And I had just absolutely no idea. And was like, whichever one was left, that's the one I'm here for. So I think, in reality, I was offered, actually the summer internships were full, but they then fast track you on to getting a grad job at one of the big four. And so I was offered a grad job at one of the big four, and I was like,
of course you were, Beth.
What am I doing?
Hang on, you're someone who wants to be an actor, who's gone and studied biochemistry, has now got a job at the big four. Of course, like, it's literally anything you turn your hand to, you're amazing.
Gosh, I wouldn't have been good at it, I promise. And I think that's again just why the whole process was so ridiculous, because it was like, you don't want me. I don't want to necessarily be here. Like, I remember turning up to the one of the days that you have to do like a kind of actual sort of sit down exam, and they take you all into a room, and someone in the waiting room was like, have you got your calculator? And of course I didn't have a calculator. I'd completely forgotten to take a calculator. And luckily the room emptied, and the session that was happening before me, I knew someone from uni there and was like, can I borrow your calculator? It's like, why didn't you bring a calculator? It's like, I don't know.
So you offered this job in tax or audit.
Yeah.
Not quite sure. Do you know which one now?
No, honestly, to this day, I'll never know if it was tax or audit. And to this day, they could be the same job. I have no idea.
They're still waiting for you to turn up.
I've got my desk ready and everything.
so what happened next then? So you turned down that really great job.
Which
people study for years to get those graduates.
And I don't
jobs.
Underestimate it at all. And I have a lot of friends that are in that industry. It just wasn't for me. It just wasn't. I don't think I could have gone in and been enthusiastic every single day about working in tax or audit. No offence to anybody doing those jobs, but I needed to do something that I could go to work about and be a little bit excited about, and actually get excited about talking to people about what I do. So then after that, I wanted to take a post-uni gap year. I wanted to go travelling. So I'd planned on going to South America. And one of my housemates from uni was working at that time in media. And she said, I think you'll really like this job. And she kind of told me a little bit about what that meant, what she did, what that meant. I was like, yeah, that does sound quite good. So I sent her my CV, and I got a phone call from the big media agency to say, oh, we've had your CV, can you come in for an interview? But I was actually flying to Chile in South America the next day. And so I said to them, unfortunately, I'm flying to Chile tomorrow. But their suggestion was I actually just go in for my interview en route to Heathrow Airport. So I rocked up to my interview. in my travelling outfit with my rucksack. I had warned them that I wouldn't be dressed smart.
Did you have a braid in your hair at this point? Or yeah. I suppose it's still too early.
I'd got henna tattoos and everything. Yeah. Yeah, I rocked up to my interview, checked my rucksack into their reception and interviewed at Mediacom.
And got the job.
And landed in Chile, and they'd email me to say, when you're back, we'd love to offer you the job.
Fantastic. And so what did you do at Mediacom? Just for, because it's a really big media company, but for people who haven't heard of it before, what does Mediacom do?
Yeah, of course. Gosh, they do absolute tons, and I hadn't gotten a huge idea of exactly what media agencies do before I really worked in one. But what the media agencies essentially do is work with all the big brands, create strategies on how they should market, and then actually put those creative spots onto TV. So if you're watching The X Factor and every ad break, those media agencies have negotiated those spots for the brands that they represent. Or if you're watching YouTube and there's an advert in front of some content that you watch, like the media agencies are putting those ads there. So whether or not it's, you know, digital or social or linear or radio. So again, there's kind of quite a varied output, but it's very much all within that, yeah, advertising space.
But then they also, it's advertising that they'll go and book your spots for you on wherever. They just do the whole job, don't they?
Yeah.
Right, you come to us, we'll sort this out.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll give you strategy, we'll tell you who to put on the adverts, we'll film it for you, we'll get it out there. Blah, blah, blah.
We'll execute it all. Don't you worry. You sit back, we'll do it for you.
And is that where you started to fall in love with the kind of creative side of things? Then, like, how creative could you be at Mediacom in your
actually not in the role, you had in the role I had, not really creative at all. I worked in the TV and digital buying team, so I was very much in that sort of day-to-day calling ITV, calling Channel 4, you know, speaking to, again, there's like various different companies that manage the YouTube inventory, so not always just Google, but working with Google. So actually doing much more of the kind of trading of ad space was what I was working with when I was at Mediacom, and that's actually how I ended up working with Disney. So that's how I ended up getting my job at Disney, because I was working with those guys. And then I was invited on a Christmas trip that they hosted every year for different media agencies. And they would take them for one day a year, just in December, they would take them out to Disneyland Paris for a day. So they would take you out on the Eurostar. Oh. I know, the best Christmas treat ever. They'd whisk you out to Euro Disney on the Eurostar, take you around, and then you'd have a swanky meal in Paris and then they'd bring you back. So that was what I was invited to my first year of Mediacom. But what I didn't actually know, that was my unofficial interview for Disney.
I love that because you've obviously just kind of, these opportunities have come along and you've just taken them as they've come. And I love that. So what do you mean? They didn't tell you that there was a job?
No, not at all. And there wasn't. I was absolutely there on a jolly. There wasn't an official job. They were still getting the headcount signed off. But I'd built quite a lovely relationship. And obviously, I always thought Disney was the coolest brand. And when I was at uni, had rung Disney, their kind of HR department, to be like, do you guys ever have a grad scheme? Or do you have grad jobs? And they were like, well, not really, no. So I think, you know, half of the battle is always getting your foot in the door. And I'd ended up working really closely with some of the colleagues that I now have at Disney while I was at Mediacom, and built quite a good relationship with them. So obviously when they're much closer to what jobs are going to be available, they can be like, oh, we think this person would be quite good. So they were introducing me to their director on this trip. And I got a phone call a few weeks later to be like, right, there's a job opening. We want you to come and interview for this with our director.
And you don't say no to Mickey.
You don't say no to Mickey.
The number one brand in the world. And do you think that you're going to be, do you want to be at Disney for a while? Or, you know, we can have this conversation this time next year and suddenly you're Elon Musk's right hand at SpaceX.
I always joke to say, like, which big brand next? Because I've done Disney and Amazon. So I'm like, who next? Who do I want to go to next? But no, I think the great thing is about these big corporates, and I have only really had a lot of, you know, majority of my kind of working experience has been at these big corporates, but it does mean there is just so much opportunity. So what I've done in each of my roles has been super varied. The brands that I work with are super varied. So that you can, you know, I have colleagues at Disney that have worked there for like 30 years because you don't just stay in the exact same role in the exact same lane. Like, the business has evolved so much. You know, Disney Plus didn't exist, wasn't even, you know, an idea when I joined in the first time that I worked there. So actually, I think there's every likelihood that I'll be at Disney when we next speak, because there is just so much opportunity that you can kind of make the most of.
Fabulous. And who's your favourite Disney character?
Oh, good question.
Who's the, when they come into the office, he's the one you're like, right, we need to stop this meeting immediately because Donald's just walked in.
I think it's still Belle, and I still feel like Emma Watson robbed me of that role. That's what's cool about this job, actually, is that you get to, you can make, you know, so many different opportunities that I have presented on the Disney Junior YouTube channel.
Fabulous. That's awesome.
Which was great. Nothing to do with what I do for my day job, but it was great. So I'm still working my way towards starring in one of the feature films. I think I'm a long way off yet, but we'll get there.
Hi, I'm Sana.
And I'm Betty, and we've been fundraising in support of the Assisted Places Scheme across each school. What's that, you ask?
The Assisted Places Scheme aims to provide access to excellence for all. So if you want to make a change,
start small and support the campaign. Thank you.
Beth, talking about your journey to here, and you know, you said earlier on, when you're talking about the grad job, the Big Four grad job, this is what everyone does, so I'm going to do it. But then you also said that you very quickly decided this wasn't for me. So you haven't really been swayed by the crowd. You may have been tempted by what other people are doing and what you feel like you should have done, but then you've carved out your own path. Do you know that you're doing it at the time, or is it instinct? Is it just, you know, heart over head going, actually, I know that this is what everyone else is doing, but it's just not right for me? Have you ever planned your career, or ended up here because the opportunities have come and you've taken the right opportunity at the right time?
Yeah, I'd love to say I've planned it, but I definitely haven't. And that was one of my worst things when I was, you know, when I was kind of an early adult, that was like, how did you get to where you are now? And people are like, oh, I just totally fell into what I'm doing. And that's so useless to hear when you're really trying to find how to make it in a specific industry. But I think the only thing that ever really persuaded me not to take those jobs that I wasn't totally sure about was that you just work for such a long time. And I remember one of my best friends at school, her dad was super successful in the finance industry. And we asked him when we were at school, like, what, you know, if you could give us any advice, what was it? What would it be? And he said to us, I chose the stake. You know, I have just stuck to this industry and, you know, I've succeeded in this industry. I really chose steak. And he was like, if I could go back to my younger self, I'd say, choose the tasting menu. Like, don't just fixate on one thing. Like, if you know what you want to do, I think that's, you know, that can be half the battle. If you know that you want to go into this vocational role, amazing. But if you aren't sure, then try stuff. Like, you know, you're going to be working for such a long time that, and you spend so much of your time working. Like, that's something that you quickly learn, that you're at work most of the time. So I just didn't want to be doing it and dreading it and not loving, you know, and having interesting conversations and then coming out of work and being like, oh, this is the cool thing that I did today. And that's totally what I get in my job. I totally get coming out of work and being like, oh yeah, I was working on the princess strategy for the next 3 years, and this is what we're doing with princesses. And some people probably think that's totally lame, but I get enjoyment
out of it. Not me. Not me. I would love to know, what is the princess strategy for the next 3 years, or is that top secret?
Oh no, it's not top secret, Ben. It has actually launched this year, but it is exactly, as we were saying, it's super relevant to what we were saying earlier, that again, keeping up with the times, stop talking about and celebrating how princesses look and their really lovely shiny hair and the pretty dresses that they're wearing. And actually, let's talk about how brave they are, and let's talk about how kind they are, and let's talk about all those personality traits that we should make young girls really proud of and want to follow and to emanate. So that's exactly how we're trying to move princesses go forward. And that's the sort of things that you can get behind, you know, having those conversations, knowing that there's so many little girls in this world that look up to Cinderella and Pocahontas, and knowing that we're trying to, you know, keep up the times, but make that change in what little girls are proud of is cool. So that's exactly why I didn't plan it, but I definitely wanted to enjoy what I do. And I think if I stop enjoying it, then I'll move roles. And I think that's what everyone shouldn't be afraid of doing. there's always something else. You're not a prisoner. Go find what you love.
You said before we started recording, I asked you, because you're recording, because we're obviously doing this all remotely still, the world that we live in. Actually, I quite like remote recording. It's good because, you know, you're in your house, I'm in mine.
Yeah, we can comfy. Just, you know,
have a quick break, have a cup of tea, come back and talk more Disney, Princess Strategy. You said, I asked you if you could record your audio on your mobile phone. I said, oh, just put your phone into airplane mode, because if you get a phone call, it will stop the recording. And you went, I'm a millennial, Ben, I don't get phone calls. Which is, do you think that's another part, this the idea, what you just said, if you stop enjoying it, move on. That wasn't really an option, I don't think, for our parents' generation, even. Definitely not grandparents. That thing of, you know, you're educated and then you get a job and that's what you do. And you climb the ladder, in that particular, whatever you've chosen right at the beginning, you climb the ladder and you stay there and you work there. Do you think that's different for our generation? Do you feel like there is more mobility within work?
Yeah, totally. I think there's more mobility. I think it's more accepted. I think it's slightly more expected that people will jump around either between industries or within their own industry, that, you know, it's rarer to just stay in your lane and to just progress in exactly what you're doing these days. And I totally agree. It definitely wasn't the norm for our parents. But again, I think there's probably external factors that also contribute to that. Like, we live in a much more digital era. So there's obviously loads more jobs and loads more industries versus when our parents were working. But also we're working, you know, much, I don't want to say longer hours because I don't want to put our parents down, but we're going to be working for a lot longer than they ever were. You know, the reality is that we're going to, if we ever get to retire, it'll be later than our parents' generation did. And a lot of our parents managed to have a setup where maybe one was at home, maybe one was working. And again, the reality for our generation is that that's much less likely. So I think there are external factors as to why our generation really crave enjoyment out of our careers as well. Whereas, you know, I think even to this day, whenever I speak to my mum about my job, to a degree, she is like, yeah, but it is a means to an end. Like, you are just, you know, you work because you have to pay bills. And actually, I don't know anyone that just sees their job as a means to an end anymore.
It's interesting because it opens up, we probably haven't got time for this, but it's a whole can of worms. And I know that with someone listening to this who has that opinion of, well, you're not here to have fun, you're here to work. And yeah. You said that as soon as you stop enjoying it, you'll move on. But actually, what you're saying is that in your current job and your current role, you're working really hard at it every single day because you're really passionate about it. I think it's got to be a good thing. I love what you said. If I'm not enjoying it, I'm going to move on. Because yeah, actually, for the company itself, you want people, you don't want someone who's been in that seat. I mean, it happens in media. I'm talking to someone at the moment and counselling a friend who's having a horrible time at mm-hmm. work because she works within a very famous organisation, which is famous for putting people on staff contracts very early on in their 20s. And then they get to their late 50s and they've been doing this job for 35 years and they can't stand it anymore and they can't be asked, but they don't have to be asked because they're on this contract with this pension. And it's so hard for anyone to get rid of them. Yeah. It's not doing anyone any good.
Yeah.
You know? So what were you going to say?
No, I totally agree. It's definitely by no means what I'm doing is, you know, I'd love to say it was 9 to 5. It is absolutely not a 9 to 5. You know, I work really closely with the US. I'm on calls all hours of the night. But so it's not, yeah, it's not necessarily about me only doing it if I like it. I think, like you said, it's kind of, am I challenged? Do I believe in yes. what I'm doing? Like, actually, can I really get behind some of these things and the campaigns that I'm working on? And I think if it ever came to a point where I was feeling jaded and actually was getting sort of less enjoyment or I was less passionate about any of the things that I was working on, that's when you should feel the freedom to move because, you know, life's too short. Don't stay in a job unless you have an amazing pension, you know, or fair play to those guys. But I think I'd really struggle to, I want to be able to go to work and like do everything to the best of my ability. And I think once you're kind of a little bit jaded by something, you're much less likely to do that.
Of course, it means that companies have got to work harder as well to retain their staff, which I don't think is a bad thing. I think it's a good thing for companies to, people are the most valuable part of any business. So to retain the best people is massively important. Come on, Beth, tell us about the perks at Disney. What's some of the ways that they retain you?
Oh, they are quite good. We get free entry to the parks. So I get me plus 3 with my security pass. Anytime I want to go any of the parks, I can get you in. we also get free tickets throughout the year. So we'll be given kind of some guest passes. So obviously in that scenario, I have to be there. But in these stories, they'll send us guest passes and I don't have to be there. So I can give them to family and friends. I've currently got free Disney Plus. And nice. I've gotten some amazing perks. I've been to some of the royal premieres at the Royal Albert Hall with the royal family there. Like, that's amazing. I would never have gotten to do that. So there are definitely ways in which they know how to keep their staff happy.
I love it. And I love this podcast because it's, like I said at the beginning, you're talking to people who have not just done really well in their careers, they're getting to the top of these things, whatever their field is. And you are absolutely on your way, Beth. But I love talking to people who are just really passionate about what they do. And you are obviously really passionate about what you do.
Yeah, I love it because I also think I didn't know this job existed. I had no idea anything about the marketing industry. I had no idea anything about partnerships. When I was at school, I feel like you're kind of quite focused on like really specific vocational careers. And actually, when you get into the big wide world, there's so many jobs and, you might have heard of a tenth of them. But actually, I think one of the reasons I'm super passionate about it is because it's like, I'm doing something so cool and I didn't even know that this job existed. That's great.
Beth, what would you say? Because we've got old Edwardians listening to this from the Boys and Girls School, but also current students who might be writing 10 different personal statements yeah. as we speak. What advice would you be in terms of them? What characteristic would you say has served you best as you've progressed from biochemistry to partnerships and digital senior manager at the Walt Disney Company?
Yeah. I honestly, this is actually something that I always say to our interns when they join. Like, honest, just be the best at whatever you're asked to do. So if you're in a meeting and you're the most junior person in the meeting, just take the notes. Like, nothing is, because there will always be someone that is the most junior in that room, but be the best person that they could possibly have there taking the notes. Like, don't ever think that something is below you, because at no point in your career is that true. You're always, reporting into someone. So actually, if you can make yourself enough of an asset, then they'll want you or in all the meetings, because they'll want you to be the one that's writing the notes. And eventually, you're not just the one writing the notes. Like, you've actually been part of these really awesome meetings with super senior stakeholders that end up then recognizing you again, and then they'll end up knowing your name and then end up being an advocate for you. So I think that's definitely, through my career, having those kind of advocates within a business has stood me in perfect stead to be able to apply to different roles, and sometimes roles that I haven't necessarily got, the most experience for versus other candidates, but they know that I'm going to come in and do it and work really hard. And that much, they've experienced because I have been in those meeting rooms, being the one that has to go and get the client's tea or being the one that has taken the notes. So I'm always saying to interns, like, just be the best possible person at whatever, even tiny task you're given. Because if you can just make yourself useful enough, then they'll want you there all the time.
Fantastic advice and a great way to end. Beth Evan, thank you ever so much for your time today on Ed Talks.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been so nice to see you.
Thank you for listening to Ed Talks. I hope that you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you have, it would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on whatever app you're listening on, so you can keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave your feedback in the review section. If you're listening on a platform where you can't leave your comments, then please do email me with your feedback. My email address is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. If you would like to feature on this podcast as a guest, then please email Adelaide Bailey at the Development Office. Her email address is aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. That's aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. She's also the person to email with any news that you think should be featuring in Old Ed's publications, either in print or online. Finally, if you think a podcast would enhance the communications of your business, organisation or charity, then I'd love to talk to you about producing it. My email address again is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me again.